everyone, and welcome to another Rip Roarin' episode of Art and Labor. I'm Lucia Love.
And I'm OK Fox.
And we're joined here today by another very special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Devin Kenny.
Oh, what's up, Devin?
Hi, Devin. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Yeah, happy Friday. TGIF, everyone.
Right. They're going to hear it on Saturday.
No way. Yeah. We're going to put up today.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice. Cool. Devin rules super hard. Everyone, when you hear this, just know that Devin has a show up at PS1 up until, I think, September 6th.
Really soon. That's why I want to get it up today.
Go this weekend. Yeah. Everybody storm PS1. But if you go on Saturday, just know that you are going to have to fight people who are doing warm-ups.
We tried to go like a couple Saturdays ago and it was a, a problem.
Yeah.
It was a bust. I got an anecdote out of it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. People searched me. All over. No. And they were like, oh, sorry, the galleries are closed. I was like, oh, you mean for 30 minutes? And they're like, no, like entirely.
Yeah, I guess at a certain time, I guess they close at the regular time on Saturday. They close at 6, but the place is still open.
It's supposed to be that way, but like your gallery, for whatever reason, they close early.
Well, they were like, oh, the art is delicate inside of the museum, so we closed a bunch of galleries. And I was like, Devin's show? And they were like, I don't know, it's delicate. Sorry, give us money and go to the dance.
I didn't.
No, it's not your
fault.
It
was our bad. I mean, really, I should have looked at the schedule.
But the show's up at PS1. Everyone has to go this weekend because
it rips, it slaps, it's thought provoking. Mm-hmm. And it's a really great culmination of things that, Devin, you've developed over the course of, your practice in combining theory and, I guess sociopolitical kind of, forces and, ready-made work and
it was
just amazing because I remember you doing performances at Lorelei Ramirez's open mic. Was it called Not Dead Yet, or was it still it's been great. And then you also were participating in Bruce High Quality Foundation, and for everyone who's not New York centered, that's a free art school that we were all kicking around at and forming ourselves.
Now defunct for
silly
reasons, but whatever.
Endings, they're always so silly.
But yeah, your work it definitely was inspired by kind of DIY or do it together art scenes. I like that a lot. I mean, and it culminates music and video and all these things that aren't just visual as well.
Mm-hmm. Sculpture, painting, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
So
gaming.
Yes. Yes. Oh my god. I loved ROM hack stuff. It's just this thing that's I love that part of you can just play any of the games on it.
Yes.
But I have a question now that we've kind of laid out sort of the parameters for some of the stuff people might experience at PS1. I just wanted to dive in to begin with the concept of character in your work and ask you about how it feels to be working with characters for this long, and how have you felt Devin Kakeni, for instance, has developed over time, or your relationship to that?
So I guess specifically with Devin Kakeni was I started that when I was just starting college. I moved to New York as a teenager to go to Cooper Union, and I started making music under the name Devin Kikini, because I was thinking about, like, I mean, this, like, 18-year-old me was, like, 17, well, however old, he was like, yeah, hip-hop and postmodern art practices both started in New York in the 70s. But it's like, what if there was some sort of, like, yeah, what if they, like, interacted and, like, met before, you know, like, before the East Village, like, 10 years later or whatever. Like, what if people from, like, downtown Manhattan and South Bronx hung out and, like, exchanged ideas and stuff artistically or creatively before, you know, the early 80s. So that was kind of it. And at the time, it was also, like, really rare for people, or, like, I guess rappers to just use their real name or some variant on their real name. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
There was, like, Mike Jones, and there was Kanye West, and there was, like, Eric Sermon, and that was it. But now it's a lot more common. Mm-hmm. But I was also thinking about this notion of, like, you know, before you become known, your name is always misspelled. Like, I don't know, I was thinking about this pro skater, Eric Costin, and his name was, like, misspelled in the first videos that he was in. And then also thinking about, I don't know, I guess, like, Andy Warhol, who is, it's like, yeah, it was like his name is Warhola, but
yeah,
they, like, misspelled his name in the newspaper and he just went with Warhol after that. So I was kind of thinking about this sort of permanent state of being, under-recognized, which I thought of as being kind of like the opposite of what rappers tend to try to cultivate or whatever. But
it's kind of like an inverted mythology or something.
Yeah.
Or, like, not inverted, but, like, the end goal is sort of, like, deflated.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, and I liked how much you think about names, like your piece where you framed, like, the notebooks full of, like, different names and
DKs,
like, yeah, different DKs, and then that the title of that piece made reference to, like, Ellis Island snafus and, like,
oh yeah, totally,
yeah, just all these different ways that were misnamed.
Yes, definitely,
yeah,
definitely. I guess speaking to the question of, like, character. Yeah, I mean, I guess I use different alter egos or, like, characters to kind of explore different ideas at times. Mm. So, like, the Devin Kikini thing was kind of exploring the space between, like, basically whenever I was, like, making music, I would use that name. And then that later, yeah, and I also created another character named Weeder Care, who, well, it's kind of like an emo indie rock type figure.
That's your normcore music video.
Yeah,
that rolled.
And I mean, it's a funny thing because, like, a lot of these, yeah, I mean, that one in particular, that was maybe like 2012 through like 2014 or something, and I was working with that because trying to think about different representations of, I guess, like, Black masculinity. But now it's interesting because, yeah, like, now it's very different. And there's a lot of rap which is, like, directly influenced by emo culture. But at the time, it was not the case. So I'm fascinated by, like, how, you know, kind of working on certain things and then they later become, like, very, yeah, normative. The use of character is usually a way for me to, like, explore certain ideas, like, within, yeah, it's basically a way to explore certain ideas, but go full, wholesale or whatever.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's just making me think now about like the lanyard video that you did where you sort of have, like, the corporate style, or like the sort of like the veneer that there's like this like really like whitewashed like eerie sort of everyone is smiling and like we're at the boardroom like we're controlling information and this is what it looks like.
And it's so like, and Devin Kakeni is credited as the lanyard, like, to do the song, but then is it a different persona that's acting?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That record, people are interested, you can get it on Bandcamp, but it's called Alone We Play. Mm-hmm. But that record is like, each song is like a little, not a micro song, but they're kind of made to be like when you have a window full of tabs. It's like each song is a tab, basically. But they're all kind of songs which are exploring intersections of like network culture and quote unquote urban culture. And yeah, on that one, it's like Devin Kakeni as ENIAC Rose. So like right. About the old computer ENIAC.
Yeah.
And like, that's kind of like a, like one of those type of, I don't know what the name or something. I don't, it was just like some sort of weird sort of name.
Well, it's super romantic sounding if you take it out of context. Like,
but it's also, yeah, I mean, it's, I really loved that piece because it was showing how, like, you know, the corporate world can completely absorb something like that can be revolutionary, like hip hop, and use it for like the most like cynical purposes, like against like, you know, Chelsea Manning.
Yeah.
Totally.
It reminded me of like Cambridge Analytica scandals.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, yeah, I just got a strong resonance of like, oh, right, this is that, like, they're all sitting in an office and they're like, yeah, how do we like tweak the population and like, what's the metrics? And here's all of these infographics. And then like, there's going to be a real effect somewhere else, but here it's just like really nice sunlight.
Yes. I guess for like, for people that haven't, well, one thing I want to say, yeah, that video was really fun because it's like a collaboration with Jared Turner, who's a photographer and also does like videography. It's really great. And I've worked with him on a few projects of my own. And I linked him with my friend Drag Lomax, and they've worked on some stuff together as well. And basically the video, it's like an ad agency is hired by the CIA to rebrand
so
the CIA
good.
After it's been discovered. Like, you know, everyone knows like a few years ago that the CIA has been like spying on people without, without consent and also without any suspicion of like wrongdoing.
Mm. I mean, hey, they're here to protect us. Like, come on.
Yeah. Like, if you have nothing to hide, then no big deal, right? And so it was like, oh, like, if this hadn't just blown over in the way that it did, like, there's, what if there was, like, they hired some group to kind of change the way we thought about the CIA, you know? So it was kind of like making a video of what some of those meetings would look like. So it's a very new corporate aesthetic. It's a you know, multicultural group of people inside of a sun-drenched kind of loft type space. And they're just like hashing out ideas. There's a lot of motion graphics, which are drawn directly from the like Chelsea Manning leaks. But they're like made to look like I don't know, PowerPoint type motion graphics. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just it's
so good.
It's so good. Yeah.
But that
tidbit about the video also, it's like it was shot in the same studio where Beyonce's Love on Top video was shot. So
wow.
If you watch the two back to back, you'll see like certain areas which are identical.
That amazing. I have to watch it again now.
That's such a fun Easter egg. God.
Oh God, that's awesome.
And extremely like depressing also.
Yeah. Well, and, yeah, it's crazy because it's the layer, like the postmodernism
Yeah, the layers.
The layers, Duke. The layers.
Another really cool aspect of the show is like you've allowed a 30-minute break for the guards to interact with your personal book shelf, which is part of the show and just the show in general. I was wondering if you had heard back from any of the workers about interacting with your show and if they got back to you about that.
Yeah.
How did they respond to it?
Well, I will say it's not like a break, but the gallery is closed for a period of time. Mm. And it's so that the people that are working in the gallery can like look at and engage with the art. I mean, they can also just like chill too. They're like not being monitored or whatever. So that's kind of like a secret aspect that I am into. Like if they're just like chilling, like texting or whatever, that would be my ideal, but also looking at art is cool, I guess. And yeah, it's been great. Every time I go to the museum, they're like, many people are like, hey, blah, 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 blah. Like, oh, I really like your show. Like blah, blah, blah. And other people have different responses. They're like, yeah, like, you know, thanks for doing that for us. Thanks for thinking about us. Like, and other times it's just like, yeah, that was really cool. I didn't realize that art could do that kind of thing. Like do so many things besides, you know, like.
Yeah, definitely.
It's more just like, you know.
It's not just a spectator sport.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it can like break down these really imaginary boundaries.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
They're like, you're Devin Kitty, yo, what's up? Like, awesome. Like your show, this and that. So it was really cool. I don't know.
That's awesome. Was anybody like, I've been playing through Sonic 3 on my breaks?
No one has gotten into depth into what they've been doing. Mm. And I never really asked.
No, that's cool.
So yeah.
How has it been kind of navigating like institutions and proposing these sort of like more unorthodox show kind of aspects? Like has it been easy to talk to everyone and be like, yeah, I just want to, you know, it's like, I just want to mine cryptocurrency from this show. Is that cool with everybody? And then everyone's like, hell yeah.
Two of the institutions that I've worked with that have been really like that, it's been really like fruitful. with this recent show, it was really good. It wasn't like instant yes on everything. Like certain things required several meetings, like with the part about having the guards be able to interact with the work, like that required several meetings because it's like it has to be set up in such a way where it's not like a break, like an additional break because of like union type stuff. Mm-hmm. And it has to be set up in a certain way where it's like, okay, you know, how do we set it up so that it is like a balance between the like museum goers and the needs of the staff, security staff. I've been supported largely. Like the curatorial folks have been very supportive in helping like facilitate, make those meetings happen and stuff. And with the tech component, the head of security at PS1 was really like, he was really great in helping us like get that together. And we also had to talk with the like IT team of MoMA, which was tricky, but also like they were supportive in the end too. Cause it's like people coming from all different angles and they, they like value culture and those kinds of things. So it was not without challenge, but in general, it was really positive. Yeah.
It's just sounds like some extra logistical stuff, but like in the end, it's worth it to break down these different like boundaries of what a show can do. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really neat to take that extra step to do that.
Totally. And I guess the main curator of the show, Peter Ely, I'd like worked with him a few years back, and basically my piece was kind of like putting slime on the wall. which, you know, as the light, hit it, you know, it started to like kind of migrate down the wall, and at certain points, like little droplets of it, like fell on people's like clothing and stuff. So he already like kind of on some other stuff. So like comparison to that, it's like, yeah, all right, well, it's not, you know.
Oh, totally.
That rolls. Cool.
Yeah, I guess some other aspects. I felt like there were so many like prescient pieces, like the I'm just thinking of the vest.
The turtle vest.
The turtle vest. I guess just like everything was so loaded once you know the history of these objects or the background, or like, you know, once you start to see them coming up in culture around us and then see them here, they take on so many different contexts. I guess I was thinking, you know, in terms of like having the cryptocurrency being mined for a bail fund, and then seeing these other sort of like aspects of the carceral state, and like I don't know, how was it putting together these narratives, or like finding and working with these objects?
I mean, I guess that's a thing that that's like part of one of the ways in which I work oftentimes, where I'm like, I'm thinking about certain, I don't want to say like cultural norms, but I'm thinking about certain approaches to things that have become kind of, standard, and kind of juxtaposing them with other standards from like other sectors of society, I guess. That particular piece, Exclusive Drip, was like kind of inspired actually by Free TK, who is a young rapper that recently, he's recently been sentenced to like 55 years in prison as a result of, you know, some I mean, he's been accused of like murder and this and that. But it's very, the evidence is like very like faulty. Anyway, I'm not going to talk too much about that, but Free TK. But I saw there was a photograph of him, and he had one of these on, one of these anti-suicide smocks on, while like behind like a bulletproof glass for like talking through a telephone. Originally they're like designed to be more humane than what they used to do, which is like just handcuff people to poles, and you would just like be standing there like with just your underwear on, or, you know, in other cases just like naked, just for long periods of time. So the person that designed it, she was like, oh, there's got to be a way to like keep the person like safe and warm while also, I guess both, mainly those two things. But it can, of course, be used punitively as well, because you're like naked underneath it. So you're walking around with this like big kind of quilted suit on, which has no strings. It has no, basically it's an anti-suicide smock because it's something that essentially you can't repurpose it in any way. Like, for example, you could repurpose the elastic in your underwear to become like a noose or something. Like, you can repurpose certain things.
Right.
And a lot of prison is trying to figure out preventative measures for people repurposing stuff.
Right.
And I am very, I, I find that, like, I don't know, I think within many aspects in, like, Black culture, there's a lot of repurposing because we're just, like, given a lot of bullshit. And if you have to, like, repurpose it into something which is, like, useful or something that can, like, keep you going in some way. So the fact that they're, like, taking away that, I think, as, like, a fundamental principle is one that I find very troubling. So...
And you relate it to these images of manga characters breaking free from confinement,
yeah,
as well. And I was wondering, like, if, like, what the relationship between that is to you.
Sure.
Did you grow up reading manga and stuff?
I did. I grew up reading manga and watching.
Us too.
But it's a funny thing because it's like, yeah, I mean, those things, they, at the time, like, in the, I was reading this stuff a lot in the 90s and I kind of stopped in like early 2000s. But yeah, it was like an underground sort of thing. Like, it wasn't easily accessible. So people were making like fan subs. So you'd get a tape and it would have subtitles. But the subtitles were made by a person that is just like obsessed with the series. So it's like there was no, you know, Netflix, there was no Crunchyroll, there was no, you know, these kinds of platforms that make it very accessible. So it was kind of like, yeah, there's a lot of more like word of mouth kind of.
Yeah, there wasn't,
change.
There wasn't, you know, Dragon Ball Z shirts at Urban Outfitters all the time.
Yes.
Which is like wild to me that exists. There was just like some Hawaiian shirts.
Right. Yeah. And then there was like Adult Swim.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Late Night.
Or Tsunami or whatever. Yeah. I was watching this thing called Saturday Anime on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Oh, me too.
You could, other than like Sailor Moon.
You can watch Lane and stuff.
Yeah.
I remember watching Lane on that, but I know there are other stuff too.
But yeah, that part was mainly in place to make it, I was thinking about the kind of way in which certain garments like shift from being like tactical garments into being high fashion garments.
Oh yeah.
And wow.
I was thinking about like how, you know, Tupac was wearing like a bulletproof vest over a t-shirt and like just wearing it outside as just like a thing. And I mean, he obviously was afraid of being shot. This is true, but it was like a kind of bold gesture to like wear it as like a fashion garment. And then eventually it with a function, but then eventually it became like, I was thinking like nowadays there's so many of these like tactical type vests which are made to look like bulletproof vests, but they have no functionality. Like people are just, you just wear it because it looks cool. Like you wear it at the skate park or you wear it when you're making your dance videos. I take a lot of these cues from like just being on Instagram and looking at people making little skate edits in the park or like dance videos and stuff. And everyone's wearing these kind of, you know, bulletproof vest looking things. But they're not bulletproof vests.
Yeah.
They're just regular vests. So I was thinking like, oh, well, if this kind of pattern continues, which I mean, I imagine it very well could, you know, eventually maybe these kind of restrictive or punitive garments that are used in like the prison industrial complex will also be repurposed as kind of like non-binary streetwear garments.
Oh, totally. I mean, I definitely have some fashion that's been inspired by straight jackets. you know, like been a very big fan of the straight jacket fashion. Maybe like that's kind of more of like an Alexander McQueen look.
Totally.
Which always ends up becoming like a dark, awkward, like resonance when you think of like the creator's life, and then you think of the objects, you think of where they're going, and it's like, Okay, like we also have that push now in fashion that is like centered around like military attributes in clothing.
Yes,
it's,
exactly.
It's very bizarre. People want to like also feel that they're like master hunters or like gunmen, and like there's been like an uptick in the camo department again.
Yeah. Bushwick dudes in hunter clothes and stuff. Like,
yeah, so
and like manga panels. Like are often bootlegged in streetwear too, so it's tying that in as well.
Yep, that was the goal. The goal is to make it look like something that you might see on like Hypebeast.
Definitely,
that was kind of the goal. Yeah,
we alluded to it before, but I wanted to go back to Bale Block because you were part of the Bale Block collective.
There's several people, Maya Binyam and. You know, there's just like, there's lots of folks that are like involved with Grayson Earle. There's a bunch of people that were working together.
So you guys are linked
Bale
with
Block. Ana Maria Rivera Forestieri. There's a bunch of folks. Yeah.
So you're linked with a particular bail fund in the Bronx right now?
At present, it's set up for immigrants' legal rights organization, which is based in New Haven. Mm. So for when I first did, basically I had made this sculpture, which was just like a crypto mining machine that was mining like Bitcoin, and it's like an anti-ad basically, because it's like, yeah, mining with these machines is totally unsustainable at this point.
Yeah.
It's kind of a complete waste of money. Mm. But so it's like, yeah, you could do this, or you could just download this app called Bale Block, which is free, and it doesn't raise your electricity bill, and basically it's like, instead of individually, it's like you can do certain things individually, and you also have a lot more power if you work collectively for certain things, you know? Mm. So Bale Block is one of those things. So it's like the more people download it, the more, the more it can ostensibly produce, but, or mine or whatever. But in this case, it's Bale Block mines another currency called Monero, which has been used by various artists for different reasons over the course of the last, you know, 5 years or something like that, 4 or 5 years.
So the PS1, the folks who have their offices at PS1 are running it on all their computers as well. And I remember when Bale Block was launched, it encouraged folks to just like, you know, just do it on your work computer, because it's like, it's not like you're using it all the time. It can run while you're not there and stuff too.
Yeah. Mm. Originally the goal was to have it just running on the computers of the like curatorial team, which is like 4 people or something. And in talking to the IT team, we ended up they're like, yeah, well, we actually have like a ton of computers just laying around, so we could just network those. Oh, okay. So it's like, there's like a miniature LAN party of just 10 computers that are all networked together that are running it constantly currently.
Wow.
So it was actually like, my goal was a lot smaller than what ended up happening, which is great.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
I think that's great. All it takes is like a little conversation and people are like, yeah, that's like pretty easy to do. Like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very heartening. Wow. I'm still like, my mind is a little bit blown still thinking about like prison being a place where meaning is reduced to a 1-to-1 ratio. I don't know. I'm like, my mind is like stuck on chewing on it right now. Just thinking of like, I guess, because before we started recording, you know, we were just talking about like getting rid of names or like, yeah. and like talking about pronouns and stuff. And really it's like, oh, what if we made our existences so, like multivalent that we had opportunities to, you know, have like fluid identities and fluid existence and everything was, but, and we think of that maybe like in the intellectual realm, of course, because society has right. its restrictions, but then I never really considered like
disposable, yeah. like the space between being fluid and being disposable.
Yeah.
Like, or, oh, you're just a number. Like if you die here, it doesn't matter. We're just going to get some other mm-hmm. person who like, I don't know, possessed, you know, a tiny amount of marijuana to be here and take your place.
Yeah. God.
Yeah, because it's like it's a revenue driver for the state, and like people are often held right. for like just a couple $100, and like
yeah,
yeah.
But just the way that those environments are created to make people feel that way, I guess I'm reading, you know what I mean. I see, but I didn't really think about like the back end of things, like. Of course, it's horrible, but then the thought process that goes into making it is, like, even worse.
Yes.
Yeah. God. I mean, I feel like it relates to your piece with the hat about how to be invisible, because it's, like, you must also be working out, like, a desire just to not be seen, but not be surveilled, and, like, how can we tackle that? And I don't know if you want to speak more about, like,
oh, yeah.
that piece.
That was a funny one because again, it's a kind of like a similar operation where I was thinking about World Star Hip Hop, where there's like, it's a website and people upload videos of themselves doing stuff. A lot of times it'll be videos of people like teenagers getting into fights and stuff like that. But there's also, you know, different material from sex workers. There's different material from rappers. There's comedians. There's quite a wide variety of content, quote unquote, on there. But additionally, there's this, I found out about, you can produce these kinds of hats, which kind of thwart closed circuit cameras, by overwhelming the video sensor with infrared light. So I like kind of created this hat, which is like a mixture of a World Star Hip Hop fitted cap. And it also has all these little LEDs, which make infrared light. So
that's awesome.
It was like, yeah, I don't know. I also at this point, a lot of the like camera technology has been like upgraded so that doesn't happen that's not like really possible. So it's kind of an anachronism. But for a good period of time, you could just, I don't know, for maybe like 50 years, you could just,
yeah.
you know, some source of infrared light, you could thwart closed circuit TV.
I guess it is sort of reminiscent of like some of the tactics that protesters are using in Hong Kong, like when they had the giant laser fight. And like there's still a lot we can do with light and cameras and... Like,
yeah, and Juggalo makeup and
oh yeah, sure.
CV Dazzle.
Yeah, CV yeah. Dazzle, yeah.
All that stuff.
So I get like personal feels about prison because my cousin is inside of it.
Totally.
Yeah.
I have a cousin that just recently got out. He was in there for a while. And that got me, I mean, I was already thinking about it a lot, but that got me thinking about it in a different way. Or just basic shit, like, you know, trying to communicate with loved ones in there, like
yeah,
they're charging
yeah, really
like
hard.
$1 in the fucking email. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
And they've replaced.
And they charge you more for putting attachments on the email. It is insane.
Yeah, and they want to replace face to face visitations with closed circuit Skype or whatever.
Yeah.
Oof.
Just brutal. Like the telecom. Industry, the hold they have over prison, just like make simple phone calls and stuff like that. These things that are so ubiquitous in the outside world that they make it just so difficult to the captive market of prison is right. inhumane.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's crazy because that's like literally we talk about in marketing, they talk about having like a captive audience or whatever, but it's like literally that's what you have in the carceral sphere. Like you have like people that like there's no other business in town. Like right. we can treat you however we want because there's no other, we have a monopoly on this particular sector of the market. It's disgusting.
Yeah, it's insane that we've just sort of also agreed that we can call it a market at this point. Like the exploitation is totally unveiled and like, yeah.
Yep.
But I liked, I don't know, it's interesting to see people like divesting from private prison structures. Like hopefully maybe they're going to start closing some, and then I don't know. I would love to I would love it if there was more reform and just ending the system and
It's just abolish prison.
Oh, totally.
Seriously.
Well, so we were talking a little
bit. Just like restorative justice and like other ways. Cause obviously the thing is like, I don't know. People are like, oh, well, what are you going to do about bad people are still going to exist if you get rid of prison. It's like, yeah, but prison's not there to improve people's lives. Prison is just there to make money.
Yeah. Seriously. And it's not like,
it's like, what the fuck?
It just like, it ruins people. Like, yeah. It's so insane. Yeah. And just like knowing, I don't know. It's really weird. Like how prevalent these terrible experiences can be in everybody's life. And just that also like it hasn't reached past the point where, we decide that logically there's so many structural changes that could be made to make people's lives like, you know, not like hit the breaking point where something has to happen, or, you know, it's like all of the crimes of survival, I guess, that could be treated so much differently by like helping people survive.
Yeah. But even people who do bad things, like it's like it's hard. You can't use them as escape, because I have an uncle who's in prison and he is a bad person. He did some really fucked up stuff. But I still don't think it makes sense to have him in prison. I just don't, because it's not when he does eventually get out, nothing is stopping him from like committing again. Like what would stop him from maybe committing again is like support networks and like rehabilitation and like these things that he really actually needs that he's not going to be getting in prison, really.
Right.
But we were talking in a hopeful note. We were talking a little before we started recording about NPR.
Okay.
We were talking about NPR.
Yeah.
Because I was just at home, and while I was at home, actually, I found out my stepbrother was assaulted by some cops and then put in jail and then taken out of jail again. And now apparently he owes the cops a lot of money because they put him in jail. And just, you know, it's, standard fucking life things going on. And then I was saying directly after that that my family was listening to NPR and they were like, oh, we need to vote for Joe Biden because Joe Biden is going to be the only thing that stops all of like this resurgence of like angry shooters, because he's like a tough guy too. But then the other alternative is Elizabeth Warren, because she's got it, you know, like, but she's like tough enough but progressive enough, and NPR says so, and that's the platform. We're not gonna go too far out, we're not gonna like go into any backgrounds, we're just gonna go like, yeah man, NPR says, and you know, it's really scary because this thing happened to our family member, and then this thing happened to our other family member, and you know what, it's happening to families all over, but Joe Biden is there, and that he gets talked about on the radio.
All I meant was that NPR, to its credit, has been publishing a bunch of like radio shows that are like pro prison abolition, which is like surprising to me because it's otherwise
like Ear Hustle is on there.
Yeah. Right? That's all I was trying to say, was it's kind of like this neoliberal network, but there is some like, I think, popular support for prison abolition, or like at the very least less prison. And I just feel like that's like an interesting tide that's turning, and something that we could utilize to at the very least like reduce the number of prisons like in our lifetime. as a very modest goal or whatever. But yeah, sorry, I was just trying to find a hopeful note in everything.
That is a hopeful note.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
My mind goes to like, oh, well, if this radical thing is now becoming mainstream, it must mean that there's something even more like deleterious that's on the way or something. But
totally.
But at the same time, it's like one thing at a time.
Yeah.
This one thing we've had for like, you know, 100+ years is horrendous.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's get rid of that.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah. I mean, it's I guess something like looking holistically at how we're going to restructure our society in the coming years. It's going to be important to consider every aspect. Like, how are we going to have like abolish prisons, like we'll have to restructure the entire economy and also think about the way that we produce things and like,
yeah.
Totally. It's a way to, I think, get people more to the left. Like, I think if like, you know, if liberals are open to that discussion, that maybe they'd be open to some other discussions about how to transform like the economy and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny thing when we think about it because it just shows that it's all on a continuum too, because these are the same kinds of argument. Like, people were making arguments against ending slavery because of this exact same thing.
Right.
And they're making arguments for ending slavery because of this sort of thing, where it's like, economically, it's not sustainable for us to continue this system. Da 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 da. We need to shift into capitalism. You know, that was the main reason why people were, why many people were, pro the abolition of slavery, and now we're in another thing, which is a kind of an aftergrowth of that. Where we talk about like the 13th Amendment being totally connected to slavery, but also the seed of the prison industrial complex.
Totally. So, that's sort of like it's like there's always two competing like ideologies of the concept of progress that comes along with the thinking of like capitalism being a progression of, you know, away from chattel slavery or something, and then like Marxist thought coming along or you know, decolonial thought in general being like, well, like there's so much tragedy here.
Yeah. I can still anti-indigenous, but it's just a different flavor.
The other thing I wanted to mention before we go is you're in Houston, and so part of the show were these like little capsules of like found objects around your neighborhood. Because I don't know like anything about like Houston. I know like the issues with gentrification are everywhere, but
yeah, it's an interesting thing because I just started kind of trying to work directly thinking about gentrification since I got here, because I was like, yeah, I mean, I've lived in New York, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, and in Houston. So those are like the four biggest cities in the U.S. and all of them, have been facing gentrification in a variety of different ways. I was like, yeah, I think maybe it's finally time to like try to think about it directly through my art practice. But in these pieces you're referring to, it's kind of, I was making these bouquets using, it started from making these bouquets coming from like weeds and also the kind of flowers that are planted on purpose, like in front of hotels or office buildings or museums. So I was like clipping these flowers and kind of making bouquets with them. And then I was doing these kind of 3D scans of them. And then I was like, oh, yeah, maybe I should try to like, that part wasn't really working out so well. So I was like, oh, maybe I'll make an a physical object out of them. So I started working with this kind of silicone-based material. But yeah, so if you see them, they're like a variety of different things. There's like flowers and there's candy wrappers and a variety of other things to kind of put together.
It's interesting because there's like plants that are specific to Houston, but it's kind of all the same city detritus that you'd find in any gentrifying city, I feel like.
Sure. The thing I was interested in it was also like kind of, I don't know, make a little bit making, thinking about, I don't know, like the like Gusta paintings and the role of painting in like the colonial project. Like we think about something just even as simple as like a still life, right?
Oh,
like,
totally.
You know, people would make a still life and it's like, oh, look at these exotic fruits from the new world.
Yeah. There is such a coding behind painting. Like if you were looking at any of the Dutch still lives, there was like always a hierarchy or hierarchical like signaling of wealth depending on like what your subject matter was, right? If you had a bunch of like wild game in your painting, that was really good. If you had oysters and lemons, that was good. If you had like some like pewter or some silver in your painting, you were like, woof, that person, goddamn, like you gotta have dinner at their house. They're gonna roll it out. Like yeah, I don't know. That's something I get into.
Like I was so in making those objects, I was thinking about that process and how, you know, like museums in a way still, many museums still do that kind of thing, just with different sorts of objects. And I was thinking, of course, of, yeah, it's a metaphor, like thinking about the metaphor of like the non-native, you know, so like certain non-native plants are viewed as a pest or a hindrance or something. And then other non-native plants are viewed as, their representation of, you know, our success. Mm-hmm. But in reality, it's just like two sides of the same coin. So that's why I have like those two kinds of things kind of put together, within this crystal clear goop.
Yeah, goop. Yeah, there's definitely also like a wide range of meaning behind the plants that we find as ubiquitous, but then also can have like these medicinal or like kind of health qualities to them too.
Yes.
Like depending on where you are and when you totally. Are, all of these things can mean something completely different or mean nothing at all, like depending on your background and the secret life of plants.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I was just finding, curious was just this notion of the, like, the invasive species, like human beings who are like not native to this like continent, being so bold as being like, oh, I hate these invasive species. Even though like a lot of the seeds that become like invasive species come from like where they're from. It's like people come from other like continents and they have like, you know, a little seed on their boot or their clothing and it like flies out and then it gets planted and then it. It's like, it's irony. There's like a lot of like irony.
There's
like settler cults, the descendants of like settlers being like, oh, I really hate this particular kind of plant. Meanwhile, I'm killing the earth by like having a lawn full of Kentucky bluegrass in the middle of the desert. You know what I'm saying? Like,
oh God, yeah. Grass needs to go.
Because that shit causes the wildfires and like...
Yeah, I it reminded me though of like a plant anecdote that do you know about the tree of heaven?
No, I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, so if you're walking around New York and you see like these, they're sort of everywhere. They have these leaves that look sort of like rice shaped and like long strands of them. And they actually are super invasive, but they were brought here during like this period of chinoiserie where all of these sort of like rooftop garden growers who were like really bougie decided that it would be cool to bring this tree from China over, but they didn't realize that it released this pollen that, like, if it was in close proximity to anything else, it would kill the other plants around it, and it would also support the growth of more of its own. So it was just this, like, it's like this rampantly like fast growing, really strong growth that has now covered like the majority of the world. Like, if there's they can grow on many different continents too now. So, like, speaking of like a seed on a boot, like the tree of heaven
is everywhere.
Is everywhere, and it attacks other trees.
God.
Yeah.
It's like when they brought all the Shakespeare birds, and now like there's like a million grackles in Central Park.
Oh God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Bring all of the real rough and tumbles over here and have the grackles fight the tree of heaven.
Heck yeah.
Oh, well, Devin, it was so nice to meet you over the phone, and everybody
hopefully
needs...
Yeah, hopefully in real life.
Oh, my God, that'd be
awesome.
I mean,
the sound, or using sound in a different way, yeah.
Well, I wanted to mention our like, studio neighbor is doing a music show for bail funds. Yeah, it's on the 7th of September at Hollow. And it's called Mutant Hall Meeting. And there's going to be like panel speakers from Brooklyn Bail Fund and Community Solidarity and Black Trans TV. And it's going to be really sick.
could you link me? I'd love
absolutely
to like promote it.
Absolutely.
That sounds super dope. Yeah.
Yeah. That's our the 83rd is our studio neighbor who's really neat in putting it on.
Yeah.
Wow.
So if folks are interested in topics like that, definitely go to that panel discussion on the 7th, and definitely go see Devin's show before it closes this weekend.
Mm-hmm. Everybody's got homework.
But yes, thank you so much for coming on Art and Labor. I hope everybody got a lot out of this discussion. I know I did.
Yeah, thank you, Devin.
thank you both.
Yeah, it was good to talk to you again.
Ditto. Okay. Have a great one.
Yeah, you
bye
too.
Yeah, till next time.
Till next time. I care if you have an aeroplane that can fly the world and we can have a fantasy. It doesn't really matter if you drive a limousine. It really doesn't matter if you drive for galaxy. I really don't care if you just drive a truck. I don't care if you just drive a limousine. It doesn't really matter if you drive a Ferrari. I really don't care, cause I just love your company. Lots of fun. Let's have fun, let's have fun. Let's have fun, let's have fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun, lots of fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun, let's have fun. Lots of fun.